states that were against Syria at one point, but now seem to have taken a U-turn. Does that new relationship mean they might be willing to fund improvements in economics and development, social development, economic development inside Syria?
Well, that is a political decision, and I don't know whether it's a totally political decision or whether it has to do with those parties who convinced them at the beginning to finance the war. You saw foreign ministers on TV saying that they put $37 billion to finance the war on Syria. So if they now don't, the war doesn't help Syria, it is, for me, understandable, because they didn't want Syria to survive anyway.
But they did open new doors of communication with Syria, for example, like the UAE.
There are new doors, but they haven't yet reached the point of becoming essential for rebuilding in Syria. Because, as I said, you know, we don't know who can and who cannot do to political circumstances and to political decision. Syria is open, and Syria doesn't have a resentment. You know, even internally, President Bashar al-Assad started a reconciliation process many years ago, and it has got its fruition, really, in the country. And therefore, we look to the future. We are not people who work on resentment and who look into the past. What I mean is that, of course, after wars, countries will go back, will start relations, but on certain basis, on the basis of integrity, of dignity, and with full respect to those who sacrifice their lives in order to protect the independent decision of the country. Mm-hmm. That's most important.
And when you say that Syrians do not hold a grudge and do not resent, it's basically because of the bringing up. And bringing up means the role of women in the Syrian society. I mean, the global war in Syria had devastating impact on women. It also had shifted their roles in the workforce inside of Syria. But consequently, women are becoming increasingly influential in the public space in Syria and shaping Syria's future. I want to read an excerpt from your book, which I would love for you to sign for me when we finish our interview. But you say, "I believe it is time Arab women learned."
This book.
Yes, I will say the exactly the title of the book, which is "Both Right and Left-Handed" by Dr. Buthaina Shaban. It's about stories of Arab women in our region. And in this book, you practically say that "I believe it is time Arab women learned not to fight men's battles while losing out themselves. I think our priority as women should be to help spread a feminist consciousness in every domain and across all categories, social categories, in order to be prepared for these struggles to come." You wrote this in the Both Right and Left-Handed in 1988.
Yeah.
Were Syrian women ready for the tsunami wave that struck in 2011, as it still has shock waves and ripples affecting the ability to create maybe even new unthinkable challenges for these women?
I don't think anybody was ready for this tsunami. I think the whole so-called Arab Spring, which is an Arab disaster, took everybody by surprise. But we quickly adapted to the situation and started to deal with it. And I really believe at times of crisis, as at other times, peaceful times, women have an extremely fundamental role to play. And in this war, as you said, women are the ones who actually bring up their children, are the ones who plant in their heads the importance of the country, the sacrifice for the country. I mean, if you see the Syrian women whose sons would go to fight terrorists and that they would receive their bodies, first son and second son, and they would say, "This is, you know, an honor for us because it is for the sake of the country." I mean, it takes really great bravery for a mother and great also belief, great faith in the country to be able to say that. Now, I wrote this book in the aftermath of the liberation also of Algeria. I made many interviews with Algerian women. And Algerian women said that we were fighting the political war, but without paying attention to our rights. And when the war was over, we did not get our rights. And what I meant is that during the war, when women are sacrificing and women are playing an important role in fighting this war, they should also think of their rights. The whole, not only women, men also should think of radicalizing the society, not just winning the war on the ground in the battlefield, but winning the social war, winning the economic war, winning the human war, winning the educational war. Therefore, that's what I mean, and I believe in that, really. I mean, I was a feminist, I'm still a feminist, but now I believe that I'm capable to fight not only for women, not only for Arab women and men, but for human being in general, everywhere. And therefore, there are basic rules that should apply that would make everybody happier. But I don't believe in Western feminism.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shaban, for your time and for your contribution to our show.
Thank you very much, Marwa, and all the power to you. I think the world needs you, not only Arab women. The world needs your voice.
I'm humbled by your words. Thank you very much.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The real image of the United States of America, or as the journal Economist called the disunited States of America, is seen on the sidewalks of Los Angeles or San Francisco, which are brimmed over with tens of homeless people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Counterpunch wrote, "One of the six dangerous promises made by Trump should be regain the White House is his plan to deport homeless people from urban centers to tent cities on the periphery. Another word for tent cities is concentration camps. As anyone with a brain can deduce, a Trump team might very well not stop with packing off the homeless to concentration camps. Next could come Black Lives Matter protesters, anyone accused of being Antifa, then all leftists in general, then immigrants. You get the picture. Arranging for forced relocation to 10 cities is a slippery slope in fascist hell. Even if it is limited only to the unhoused, it would be an execrable violation of their human rights. So it is to be opposed on all counts. Even more so considering we have available housing for homeless people right now. Just in San Francisco, there are 10 houses sitting empty for every one person sleeping on the street. As San Francisco District 5 Supervisor Dean Preston tweeted on October 13th, "We have the housing, but the homeless can't pay for it. Hello, what about nationalizing it? Or less radically, the government could purchase it at a reasonable rate and then give people who need it shelter. But that involves ditching capitalist chivalrous, and the U.S. rulers are extremely rigid about those." It's time to instill some flexibility in elites, not only regarding housing but also with food. Worldwide, plenty of food is produced, enough to feed everyone. It's just that unfortunate economic and political arrangement dispossessed so many billions that many of them can't afford it. As a result, hundreds of millions of people don't get enough calories each day. That's easy to fix. You just have to decide to do it. And that requires not being a blind capitalist ideologue. In the US, Americans have the novel and uniquely widespread phenomenon of homelessness. People who live in their cars. But with the skyrocketing price of gas, thanks to Biden's idiotic Russia sanctions to bolster his Ukraine proxy war infamy, these poor folk may soon have to trade down from their sedan to a sleeping bag on a city sidewalk. If they do that, they will incur the wrath of the affluent, who consider them a blight on neighborhoods that could otherwise sport eaters with $10 coffees and $30 sandwiches, or expensive gyms, or any other of the commercial ornaments of the districts of the rich. So, not surprisingly, Trump's plan for 10 cities is widely approved on the political right in the U.S. The homeless are so unsightly, you see. Their misery is supposedly their own fault, because they allegedly use drugs and are often falsely accused of not wanting to work. Rightists skip over the inconvenient fact that many, maybe even most of the people sleeping in their cars do work, like whole armies of adjunct professors, but they get paid so pitifully that they can't afford shelter. Or right-wingers become hysterical about homeless being mentally ill. Well, provide care. That's not complicated. However, it does cost money. But it's easier to scream that vagabonds are not, the implication being dangerous. The equation of mental illness with violence is a pernicious lie, because the most lethal Americans are gun owners, and very few crazy people own guns. They're too busy trying to cope and survive the agony of cohabiting with their internal demons. Whatever the excuse, the wealthy, along with Trump's rabidly fascistic base, which includes many of the nation's police, want the homeless to scram. They want to reclaim U.S. cities as the playgrounds for the rich that they think they were meant to be. Some of the homeless use drugs. Some doubtless sell small quantities of them. A homeless drug dealer? That would be a tougher for the radical right. Vagabond drug dealers, no doubt, would require separate tent camps. They might even get their tent cities blatantly repurposed as death camps. And what starts as an exception for a pariah caste could soon become the norm for the larger group, because when dealing with such a big problem, reactionaries may soon conclude that nothing small will do. After all, there are lots of homeless people in the U.S., officially 500,000, though that statistic is belied by another from the National Center on Family Homelessness, which says 2.5 million children are homeless each year in America. So they have, at a minimum, 3 million unhoused souls in America. Just from casual observation of city life and from the sordid abuse of statistics by American officialdom, is that they have more than 3 million homeless people, maybe millions more. But that's just a hunch based on another manipulated statistic, namely the unemployment one. Since unemployment stats diabolically delete the throng of long-term unemployed people who have given up looking for work, the question naturally arises, how do they live? How do these uncounted jobless, perhaps millions of them, pay rent with no income? Well, they probably don't. There is no charge for sleeping under the stars, and that's about all you can afford it if you are unemployed for years. True. You run the risk of getting beaten up by the police or dying of exposure. And if Trump is re-elected, you could be shipped off to a tent city where the first question to arise is, how will you eat? But if you are one of the droves of unnumbered, invisible people who have been unemployed for years, this miserable calculus is all old hat. After all, food and shelter are luxuries for millions of Americans who have been trained by the rigors of austere capitalism to do without the latter and skimp, to put it mildly, on the former. To Trump and his fellow fascists on the GOP right, homeless people are dangerous and deranged. Yet, according to Invisible People, a group that supports the unhoused, homeless people are murdered at a rate 25 times higher than those who have a residence. Indeed, 640 homeless deaths took place in the streets of New York City in 2022 alone. But the homeless are far more likely to be portrayed as perpetrators. That's because they are depicted as a not like us. They are not neat and clean. They don't get to shower every day or sleep in a bed. All these features of vagabondage set off alarm bells on the political right, and they affront the class snobbery of the well-to-do. No fixed address, little bathing. Clearly, these people must be psychotic and threatening. Clearly, they belong out of sight in tent camps. Clearly, respectable people should not be asked to feed them when they are confined in those camps, because clearly they don't have much right to life. They forfeited that when they committed the offense called poverty. The website of Hill wrote, "The typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of as a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless, nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They're frequently overlooked in the debate on how politicians solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the Supreme Leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, you know, I would like to ask you a question regarding, abortion, but non-deliberate abortion of a fetus, all right?
Yes.
Regardless of the fact that wherever or in which stage of pregnancy the mother is, right? So my question is that if abortion of this fetus is not deliberate,
yes,
should the mother pay any blood money? And if yes, how much?
Well, I would like to put it in this way, that if miscarriage takes place and the child dies by itself, mm-hmm, without the father or the mother being involved in the death of the child.
Yes.
Obviously, in that case, because the mother is not guilty, because no mother, actually, generally speaking, no mother wants to kill her child, no mother wants to, give birth to a dead child. Therefore, miscarriage is something that happens. You know, there are lots of women who
experience
miscarriage. Yeah, who experience a miscarriage. So, of course, abortion is not mandatory. There's no objection to the woman who miscarries a child.
So there's no blood money.
There's no blood money.
I see. Thank you very much. And my next question is, on the advice of the doctor treating a pregnant woman, all right, and she found it necessary to have an operation for her gums and teeth. Is it permissible for her to have an abortion on the grounds that the anesthesia and X-ray are going to deform the fetus?
Well, it's very absurd to hear, such claims or such excuses by some women who want to have X-ray, fearing that the fetus is going to be deformed, or she is going to, let's say, give birth to a child who is either suffering from paralysis or some difficulties, of course, anomalies, and so on and so forth. This is not the valid excuse for having abortion. Of course, the reason mentioned in the question you just posed is not valid for terminating the pregnancy. So it's not permissible for the woman to have abortion.
I see. Okay, and my next question, Sheikh Javid, is that if it is known for sure that the baby will suffer intrauterine death and continuing with the pregnancy proves dangerous to the mother's life, is it then permissible to abort it? And assuming that the husband follows in taqlid of a mujtahid, who is of the opinion that such a case does not warrant abortion, whereas the woman and her relatives follow another mujtahid who sees it otherwise, what should the husband do?
As far as I understand, the scenario of the question, actually suggests is that of the inevitable death of the fetus alone, or the death of the mother or her baby. So if this is the case, there is no alternative but to abort the fetus in order to save the mother, because the mother's life comes first. It's more important And when it comes to choosing between the mother's life or and the fetus, of course the mother's life is more important, and of course she can abort the child, or of course if she is not in a position to abort the child, those who are responsible and those who are in charge of taking care of the mother, they can go ahead terminating the pregnancy and safeguarding or protecting the mother's life. You know, the husband has no right to prevent his wife from aborting the fetus when it comes to saving her life, because she has every right to save her life. And it, of course, it's obligatory, if possible, to act in such a way that killing the fetus should not be seen as the responsibility of anybody. So it's very much important for the woman to have abortion only when it's necessary for her to save her life. And if in the event that she does not take such an action, she will end up dying. So in that case, she has every right, of course, to terminate the baby.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the Islamic laws related to the medical issues. Well, Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to abort the fetus, let's say, at the stage of the fertilized egg, all right?
Yes.
If the pregnancy has come about as a result of a mistaken sexual intercourse by a non-Muslim or as a result of adultery?
Well, mistaken sexual intercourse, as they put it in Arabic, al-wath bi-shubha, and then, or adultery, these are not excuses, proper and valid excuses for having abortion. As I said, when it comes to all these excuses, these are not sensible reasons, these are not reasonable excuses for having abortion. And the scholars, the jurists, are all agreed on the fact that it is not permissible to have abortion in these scenarios.
I see. Okay. Well, and my next question, Sheikh Javid, is that, you know, if a woman, a pregnant woman who's 4 months old,
yes,
heard that, you know, it is permissible during this period because the soul didn't enter the fetus to have an abortion, this is what she thinks, without any reason. Is it permissible to terminate the unwanted pregnancy simply because she doesn't want to be pregnant?
Yeah, that is quite clear. I think we can understand from what we have already discussed in not only in this episode but also in the previous episodes that aborting the fetus during any period of pregnancy is not permissible, let alone the scenario that you just mentioned, because you just said for example, that the child is 4 months. You know, it is because of her ignorance, because she thinks that, okay, or maybe she has heard someone say it, but she has no knowledge of Islamic Sharia, and therefore it's quite your question. I think you just quoted someone who brought that excuse, saying mm-hmm. that, okay, 4 months, and at this, yes. This stage, of course, it's permissible to have abortion. And that quite suggests that she has no knowledge of Islamic Sharia. Based on the the fatwa or the verdicts issued by the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it is not permissible under any circumstances and on any account to abort the fetus at any stage of pregnancy. Let's say the woman is 1 week pregnant or 2 week pregnant or 1 month pregnant, and mm-hmm. it'll go up. You right. can say the doctors, according to some specialists, the fetus gains life at around the four month of pregnancy. At that stage, before that, after that, it's not permissible to have abortion. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are exceptions. We have discussed it already, and yes. I think it's not necessary, and it's not actually reasonable to repeat my answers to those questions.
And those listeners could refer to our archives. Just simply, they need to search Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. This is the name of the program and the whole radio station. So thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran slapped sanctions on nearly two dozen entities and individuals affiliated with the European Union for backing and inciting terror and chaos in the country. Palestine calls on the International Criminal Court to probe the Israeli crimes amid anger over the latest raids in the occupied West Bank that left six Palestinians dead. And Ukraine says there are no signs that Russian forces are abandoning Kherson, as Kiev prepares for a counteroffensive to retake the southern region. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has slapped sanctions on nearly two dozen European Union entities and individuals for supporting terror activities during the recent riots in the country. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said those blacklisted include eight institutions and 12 individuals. He said the bans are imposed in response to the EU's unconstructive measures against the Islamic Republic. Amir Abdollahian said that the targeted entities and individuals were found supporting and inciting terror, extremism, and violence in Iran. The top diplomat once again warned the EU against pursuing its failed and well-worn approach toward Iran. He made the remarks during a meeting with his Belarusian counterpart in Tehran. Iran is once again calling on the UN to break its silence on the Israeli regime's continued aggression against Syria. According to Iran's ambassador to the UN, Israel is targeting Syrian civilians and infrastructure in clear violation of international law and human rights. Amir Said Iravani says the UN's silence has further emboldened the regime. Israel frequently strikes targets inside Syrian territory. The Damascus government has repeatedly urged the UN to condemn such acts of aggression. On Monday, the regime's warplanes fired several missiles at targets near the capital, Damascus, leaving a Syrian soldier wounded. We reached out to journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas to get his thoughts on why the UN refuses to react to the Israeli aggression.
I think the hypocrisy of the UN has been laid bare so often that it beggars belief, to be fair, and even having to comment on it is almost insulting for any analyst, really. The United Nations is basically a body which implements whatever primarily the Anglo-Zionist Empire wants done in the world. And so what they want done here is the breakup of Syria. They continue to be allowing Israel to support Daesh terrorist forces on the ground in Syria. They continue to supplement and support the occupation of Syria by the Americans, just for one, the Western forces along with them. They continue to help advance Israel's periphery doctrine, which is a well-set doctrine which says that they will control all of the countries, even on the peripheries of Israel's borders, etc. They are clearly part and parcel of the Yinon plan, which the Odin Yinon plan that Israel has in place, which says that from the sea right to the Euphrates River is essentially Greater Israel, and that's what they've always wanted in one way or another, whether it's through satellite puppet regimes as in Saudi Arabia or Jordan or various other nations that surround them, the majority of them. That's exactly what they continue to want to do.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry is calling on the International Criminal Court to probe the Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. The ministry has condemned continued deadly aggression against Palestinians. Also, Iran and Jordan have separately denounced Israeli raids across the occupied territories, calling on the international community to protect Palestinians. Meanwhile, the European Union has expressed its regret over the latest killings in the West Bank, but stopped short of condemning the regime's crimes. The Israeli military raids on Nablus and Ramallah left 6 Palestinians dead overnight on Tuesday.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition.
Those Palestinian young men will not be defeated by the Israeli war machinery. The Israeli occupation will pay a high price for its crimes. The response will be in the field. The flag of Wadi Hawa and other martyrs will continue flying every day, and more Palestinian heroes will be born.
The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Ukraine says Russia is strengthening its forces in the southern Kherson region, preparation for an imminent counteroffensive by the Ukrainian military. According to an advisor to President Volodymyr Zelensky, the heaviest of battles is going to take place in Kherson as Moscow's military is digging in to face advancing Ukrainian forces. The official says there are no signs that the Russian forces are abandoning the area. Instead, they are replenishing and strengthening their grouping there. Moscow has been evacuating local residents in anticipation of a Ukrainian counterattack to recapture the city. Kherson is one of the 4 regions that Russia officially annexed last month. Moscow says people in those provinces showed overwhelming support to join Russia in referendums. Kherson is thought to be the most strategically important region among the 4. Russia has once again accused Ukraine of planning to use the so-called dirty bomb in its own territory. The latest accusation comes from President Vladimir Putin amid rising tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine. In a meeting with the intelligence chiefs of several former Soviet countries, Putin warned that the risk of conflict in the world and the region is high. He called for higher security measures around key infrastructure sites. In the meantime, the Kremlin says that Moscow will continue to convince the international community that Ukraine intends to detonate a bomb laced with radioactive contaminants. Russia has already submitted a letter to the UN Security Council on the issue. Kiev, however, denies such allegations. Also earlier, the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg reaffirmed Ukraine's claims.
Russia now falsely claims Ukraine is preparing to use a radiological dirty bomb on its own territory. NATO allies reject this transparently false allegation. Russia often accuses others for what they intend to do themselves. We have seen this pattern before, from Syria to Ukraine. Russia must not use false pretexts for further escalation. The world is watching closely.
The NATO chief said the Russian president's nuclear rhetoric is dangerous and irresponsible. He noted that Russia must understand that it should never use a nuclear weapon in Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden has also warned that Moscow would be making an incredibly serious mistake if it used a tactical nuclear weapon. The Kremlin calls such claims part of a campaign by the West aimed at undermining confidence in Moscow. The United States, Japan, and South Korea are promising an unprecedented response if North Korea decides to go ahead with a much-speculated nuclear test. Deputy foreign ministers of the three countries held a news conference after their talks in Tokyo. South Korea's Cho Hyun-dong warned of an unparalleled scale of response, while his U.S. counterpart, Wendy Sherman, urged Pyongyang to refrain from provocations that destabilize the region. And Japan's representative referred to the three nations' resolve to deepen cooperation. They believe that North Korea is preparing to conduct a seventh nuclear bomb testing. Also on Wednesday, thousands of South Korean Marines staged amphibious landing drills. The exercises are part of a larger 12-day war games, some of which are conducted jointly with the U.S. Pyongyang sees the war games as an existential threat. Bangladeshi rescue workers find more dead bodies after a devastating cyclone lashed into the country's southern coast. Officials say that they have found the bodies of four missing crew of a dredger boat, raising the death toll to 28. About 1 million people were evacuated from the area before Cyclone Sitranj hit on Monday. Winds gusting up to 80 kilometers have left a trail of devastation in densely populated coastal areas. About 10 million people have been without power in areas along the coast after electric poles were damaged. South Asia has experienced increasing extreme weather in recent years. The worst recorded storm killed hundreds of thousands of people 5 decades ago. Despite 2 decades of American military presence in Africa, on the pretext of combating extremists and terrorists, the security situation in the region is an absolute nightmare. Statistics show that U.S. arms and training have failed to contribute to their stated goal of reducing terrorism and militancy in Africa. The figures demonstrate that they have rather prepared the ground for persistent and thriving terrorism across the continent.
After 20 years of American deployment in Africa, the Pentagon has admitted that the area is getting worse. The Pentagon says the security environment has deteriorated and that violence has expanded in intensity and geographic reach. A report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies has shown that militant attacks increased by 300% in Africa over the past decade. Violent events linked to militant groups have doubled since 2019. More than 6,200 violent events were attributed to terrorist groups in 2022, a 21% increase from the previous year. Almost 15,000 deaths were linked to the increase in terrorist-related activity. The West Sahel region and Somalia were the militancy hotspots where nearly 95% of the attacks had been carried out since 2019. Extremist groups affiliated with Daesh and Al-Qaeda militants, such as Al-Shabaab, are mainly responsible for the attacks. In this regard, the Pentagon's African Command, or AFRICOM, whose area of responsibility covers all of Africa except Egypt, describes the duties of the force as promoting regional security, stability, and prosperity, while assisting to strengthen the security forces of allied nations. But it also admits AFRICOM will work to advance U.S. national interests on the continent. Both Somalia and the Sahel are actively hosting U.S. troops, and the U.S. now has some 30 military bases scattered across Africa. Former U.S. President Donald Trump had ordered the military to pull out all its troops from Africa. However, the incumbent ordered the U.S. military to maintain a permanent presence in Africa. Last year, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized the deployment of hundreds of American troops to reestablish a persistent U.S. military presence. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. Also, Washington does not have a good track record, even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Somalia is a perfect example of systematic American military failures across the continent. After 2 decades of deployments, drone strikes, and commander raids to fight al-Shabaab terrorists in the country, the militant group has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country as well as neighboring states.
In recent years, there has been growing recognition that the U.S. is militarizing its foreign policy in Africa, especially following the establishment of the Africa Command in 2007. Years of U.S. military presence have only meant that Washington was getting involved in coups and the overthrow of several governments in Africa.
History has shown that the U.S. has brought instability and conflict to any region it has established a military foothold. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya have all been subject to U.S. interventions and are experiencing chaos as a result. In recent years, there has been growing recognition of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa, especially following the establishment of the Africa Command in 2007. Despite its years-long military presence in Africa, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, but has also been involved in coups and the overthrow of several governments. Since 2008, U.S.-trained African military officers have attempted at least 9 coups in 5 Western African countries. According to a report, 8 such coups, which took place in Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Mauritania in different years, were successful. The failed coup was in Gambia in 2014. Confirmation is reported from the U.S. Africa Command that several African military leaders who staged coups in their countries participated in AFRICOM's flintlock exercises. Since 2015, 5 coups have been carried out by military leaders who had previously participated in Special Operations Command Africa flintlock exercises. The U.S. Department of Defense claims that these exercises, which were first conducted in Africa in 2005, are intended to strengthen the capacity of African countries to fight terrorism. But are they? Despite their claims, Americans have only been harbingers of more coups and more instability in Africa.